All right, so I'm going to begin, just take a few minutes to go over a few introductory things, and then we'll get into our four questions that we had you do. Hopefully you had a chance to do it, especially number four. That is a really rewarding thing. We're going to go through some of those and probably spend maybe half our class looking at that, because I want to be sure that we've done some of that so you can see what kind of study that is. So just beginning, I want to look at a couple of things, three questions. You know, who wrote the book? Just real quickly, not to spend a lot of time, where was it written, from where was it written, and to whom was it written? I'm sorry, when was it written, and to whom it was written? So first of all, who wrote the book? Just keep this in mind, especially in reference to the fact that, you know, we study with other people about baptism. If you get with somebody that's pretty educated and you try to quote Mark 16, verse 15 and 16, they're going to tell you, well, the end of Mark's gospel from verse 9 on is not original. They're going to try to suggest a lot of liberal critical scholars believe that. And there's reasons for it when you look at it textually. It's a little bit different that to say Mark ended there. I finally came to the conclusion that Mark's gospel ending from verse 9 on is authentic, because if you remove that from the gospel, you remove any witness of Christ after his resurrection. And that is paramount to the gospel of Jesus Christ. So because of that, I believe that it is part of the original. But instead of trying to argue with him like that, take him over to 1 Peter. 1 Peter 3, verse 16. Because no credible source, liberal or conservative, argues that this book was not written by the Apostle Peter. It is, from everybody's viewpoint that would matter, they believe Peter wrote this epistle. Now, when we get to 2 Peter, it's a different story, but we'll worry about that when we get over there. So just keep in mind that no credible source believes that or doubts that the Apostle Peter wrote this book. There's a lot of external evidence. In other words, when we talk about external evidence, we're talking about in the few centuries following the first century, when you have the church fathers, they refer to, the writing, members of the church writing different letters around. They quote from this book quite often. Many scholars look to that for credibility for the book. And so there's a lot of evidence there to 1 Peter. It's quoted a lot. And the author claims to be the Apostle Peter. I mean, for me, when it comes to the book being authentic, I look to the text for validation. And you'll see what I mean when we get to that fourth question of the introduction. just so much of it, it's very apparent that the Apostle Peter is the person behind what's being written here. So the author makes a statement in the book that would be quite natural for Peter to make, referring to Mark as his son in the faith. However, the greatest testament that can be seen easily is when we compare these Peter's reminiscing about his life with Christ. And he does that so much in the book. The only slightly credible evidence that it wasn't written by Peter is that this book is written in a very high quality of Greek, which many would say would not be normal for an uneducated, when we talk about that uneducated man such as Peter, but it was very common in the first century for writers such as this to use an amanuensis, a secretary, a scribe, whatever you call it, to write. And you know, and also Silvanus, being his scribe, would be very highly educated. Scribes were very highly educated and could write very, very good Greek. So it's also significant that Peter never uses the term church in the epistle. I don't know if y'all noticed that as you read through it, but some interesting stuff about that. So that suggests that Peter, you know, who wrote the book? Well, Peter did, the Apostle Peter, and just about everybody believes that. From where was it written? Well, there's a statement in the latter part of the book, chapter 5, verse 13, that's very confusing. If you've read any commentaries on this verse, you know that there's just all over the place. He makes reference to Babylon. Who is she in that verse? Let's just look at that verse real quick. 1 Peter 5, verse 13, when he says, "She who is in Babylon, elect together with you, greets you, and so does Mark my son." Suggesting that's where Peter was when he was writing this book, in Babylon, and she who is a, who is she, and where is Babylon? And then Well, I mean, obviously, one possibility is we're talking about liberal Babylon. Some suggest that it's Rome, and Babylon's being used figuratively there, and some have suggested Egypt. Very simply, there's no evidence whatsoever that Peter was ever in Babylon or Egypt. To me, it makes sense that Babylon's being used figuratively here to talk about Rome. There's a lot of evidence that Peter was preached and taught in Rome quite a bit. So, and it makes sense that at the time of Nero's persecution of Christians, that he would want to keep his whereabouts hidden a little bit, especially if he's in Rome where Nero would be. She is probably the church, the bride of Christ, referred to as in the feminine form. This depicts God's people as a woman. It's done in both Testaments. Isaiah 37 is one place you can go. Maybe you think about Revelation as well. Revelation chapter 12, when it talks about the church there. Other places, 2 Corinthians 11:2, among others. The church is referred to in the feminine. And so my suggestion is to you, she is the church. The church in Rome greets you, is what I believe Peter is saying there in that text. And when was it written? The epistle seems to explain an impending and intensifying persecution to come to Christians outside of Rome. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in a moment. But when Peter, probably in Rome, he would be very well aware of the growing hostilities towards Christians by Nero. And then, of course, we know that Nero launched this persecution on Christians AD 64, around that year. And so this would be a book that prepares them. So many have suggested this was written in the early 60s AD, this book was. Now, who was it written to? Well, he mentions there in the very first verse, to the pilgrims of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, and Asia. So that's the northern part, let's see, up here, the northern part of Asia Minor. Sorry, it's a very crude, simple map there for you to see. So, y'all remember, and there was a book written to these over here. Do y'all remember where that was? What book is that in the New Testament? Anybody? I'm thinking particularly chapter 2 and 3 of Revelation, right? So, these seven churches are in this area. Peter's writing to this area in 1 Peter. And depending on where you take your Acts study, I take an early date for Revelation. Sorry, you got me saying Acts. Revelation, I think an early date is going to be pretty similar to the time Peter's writing too. And he's also suggesting persecution there. So interesting stuff there. And that's really all I wanted to say on just the introductory stuff. So I wanted to move over and look at our questions. And let's get some involvement in the crowd here. So the first question was just to read through the book of 1 Peter and to, you know, think of it. When you read through the whole book, what kind of theme jumps out to you? Anything in particular? Were there any text in the book that suggests a theme for you for the whole book? Now we've got, what is the text? Holy living in a hostile world, but that's for our whole study, okay? So with just 1 Peter... And I guess if you looked in my book that I have a little bit of a different title for it, for 1 Peter. And mine is the theme, The Proper Response to Christian Suffering, Exhortations to Glory. But is there anything in the book, a verse or anything that jumps out at you as a kind of a theme for the whole book? Byron? Hope, okay. Hope is used quite a bit in the book. And I think maybe as an underlying reason for the exhortation that he's giving you. So what is the exhortation that we see in the book? What is he exhorting us to do? Do what? I'm sorry? Okay. How do we do that? I think the book's really talking about how do we endure that suffering. In light of the suffering, what is he exhorting us to do? Be submissive, that's part of it. Remain steadfast, that's part of it. I'm looking for an overall that covers everything. It's real simple. And it's found in the first chapter. Have faith, okay, and that's it right there. Be holy, for I am holy. And I think when we get to the outline, you'll see what I mean. I mean, he says that, and then he spends the rest of the book, in my opinion, telling us how we do that, how we live holy lives. Living holy lives, well, I like it. You know, I don't know if, let's just go to the outline part, because I think that comes out pretty well. So here's an outline I found online. Wow, that is not what it looked like on my computer. Sorry about that. Greetings to the people of God. Salutation is participating in community, the responsibility of being God's people, of being a community of faith. I mean, hope and holy aren't even found in that. That's just one I found online. I mean, I think this person doesn't even see what the book is talking about. But here's the... Daniel let me borrow this commentary. I asked him to. It's pretty... Tyndale, Wayne Grudem, wrote this. And he has an outline in here, and it's kind of... again, this is not what this is supposed to look like. But so these first few verses, chapter 1, verse 3 through 12, just a salutation. We see that similar in a lot of books. And then he talks about how to be holy in the midst of unbelievers. I think that really encompasses what this book is trying to teach us, what Peter is trying to teach us. So living in the world, living amongst unbelievers, how do we live? Chapter 1, verse 13 through chapter 5, verse 11. I mean, he goes through, and I kind of broke his out a little bit, this section 3, into some other things. You know, the call to be holy and why. There, the latter part of chapter 1 and into chapter 2. Holy living towards governing authorities, how we live holy in that respect, how we live holy towards masters, servant-master relationship, how we live holy in marriage relationship, how we live holy in suffering. And that's a big section there. So, because we remember we talked about that he's talking about an impending persecution coming. And so he's telling us throughout all of this how to do that. Be holy, for I am holy, and here's how you do that. How we're supposed to act. So that's what I came away with as a theme for 1 Peter. Now, when we get over to 2 Peter, he's going to talk about, in my opinion, in light of false teachers, not persecution. It's going to be a little different reason there. But any thoughts, any further thoughts? These are a couple of outlines. Let me explain to you why I think it's important to find a simple... Now, this book, that outline came from like a 2.5-page outline that he has in this book. I don't know where it is here exactly, but, you know, having a really complicated long outline is good for maybe research, but from the person who sits in the pew, from the person who's just out every day on the street, it's important to have a memorization of a very simple, short outline, I think. Go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead. So, it's good stuff. Just a simple outline is good to have because I know when I'm studying with somebody and I need to reference a scripture about holy living in marriage relationship. Oh, I remember 1 Peter, the first part of 1 Peter 3 talks about that because I've just got this simple outline memorized. I don't know exactly the verse I'm looking for, but I can get close by having this simple outline memorized. And that's really all we need to do. We don't need to memorize the Bible. I mean, we can just know these short passages. So I really like books when we can find a verse in the book that outlines the book. I mean, Acts does that. Acts chapter 1 and verse 13 or somewhere around there is a good outline for the book. Romans does that. For I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to all who believe, to the Jew first and also the Greek. And I'm not going to remember the end of it. For the just shall live by faith. But anyway, that outlines the book of Romans for you. It's a verse. Now, 1 Peter, I haven't found a verse that outlines the book. Maybe there's one there and I've just missed it, but it's good to have a good outline, just a little short, easy one to remember that does what you need it to do. Anybody else have some additional information on a theme or an outline that you want to share? Right. Yeah, this next question, too, is going to really... emphasize that 1 Peter is very serious about this too. Let me just ask you this simple question too. So, in light of this theme, and the outline that we've looked at. We go to 1 Peter 3:21 a lot to talk about baptism. How does that fit into this theme? Because the initial thought of that looks like, well, that doesn't fit into, holy living. It doesn't fit the idea of how we live holy to God. But, Tim? In what way? Chapter 3 doesn't. It does. It connects us with Jesus, but how does it connect us with Jesus? Yeah, it does, but chapter 3 doesn't. Yeah, chapter 3 doesn't. What does chapter 3 talk about? Look at verse 18. For Christ also suffered once. It's the suffering. He suffered as an example for us. He talks about that beginning at the end of chapter 2. And I only bring that up to mention that it's okay for us to use 1 Peter 3:21 to talk about baptism saves us. I mean, that's a fact that is stated right here in the Bible. But it's in the context of Christ suffering and us enduring suffering that's written in that context.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so that's another idea. Right, good point. Good point. And that may be actually more prominent than what I'm bringing out here, that it's the real reason is because it's the basis for our hope. Right, so, and then more to Byron's point too, because he connects that baptism, that we're saved through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And that's our hope. That's where our hope lies too, with that resurrection. Yeah, right. That almost ties those things together, everything in between. But so let's look more. Any other thoughts on those two verses? Tim? Yeah, I think verse 15 and 16 is probably our theme passages for the whole book. It doesn't really outline the book for us, but it is our theme passage for the whole book. Let's look at this next one, number 3. I asked you to look at the handout imperatives in 1 Peter, and one of the things that I'm reminded of before we get into that is that another thing, and I don't know how I think of Jody about this, because Jody, he reinforces this with us all the time, is that, so think about this idea of holy living in the midst of unbelievers, and quite often, all throughout the book, he interjects, I talked about holy living in the servant-master relationship and holy living in the marriage relationship, but he throws in there all along, and then he ends it with this idea of how we are to treat one another. So the holy living amongst one another is a big part of this book, but it's just mixed all in there, all throughout the book, suggesting to me that that has a huge part, a huge influence on our impact to the outside, to the unbelievers, how we treat one another. See if you don't see that as you read through the book and as we study through the book, that's suggesting to us that it is critically important to our influence on the outside world how we treat one another here as brethren. So thinking about that and thinking about the serious tone of this book, I mentioned in the third question that looking at these imperatives in 1 Peter, it just enforces with us how serious the tone of this book is. Even though just reading through the book, we really don't get a sense of a serious tone. But if you just think about all of these imperatives, it really does suggest that it's very serious. Be sober. Set your hope on this grace. Be holy. Love one another. Honor all men, fear God. I mean, all these imperative statements that he makes, these commands, if you want to put it that way. Honor the king. There's a couple in here that I think are a little bit of a stretch. But finally, be ye all. I'm not even sure what that means. So, I adapted this from a handout that I have that I thought was really interesting. He says again in chapter 4 and chapter 5, be sober. I probably could combine that with number 1. He says it 3 times in the book. Gird yourself with humility. Humble yourself. Be watchful. I mean, just There's 33 he has listed here, actually 35 if you count the two other, the sobers mentioned three times. 34, I guess, because he just puts two in there for number 21. So I just wanted you to kind of go through this and see just how many imperatives are in this book. So it does have a very serious tone. And so I want to spend some time. Does anybody else have any comments on that, number three? I want to spend some time on number four. How many of you got a chance to go through number four and do that whole thing? I just looked at every one of those. Did y'all figure out what was going on? I mean, I guess from the question I kind of pointed out, but I mean, this is a really rewarding study to do this. So I want to do some of it. We probably won't have time to do them all, but I want to do some of these together with you. So if you'll notice, at least for 1 Peter, maybe we go down and do the first 11 if we get a chance to do that and consider what he says about these things. So do y'all understand what I'm trying to get you to see here? Is it clear that Peter often, as he's writing this epistle to whoever his readers are, he's thinking back a lot about his time with Christ and the different things about Christ. He's reminiscing, if you will, about his time with Christ, and he's sharing that with his readers. So the first one he mentioned, I mentioned several verses in 1 Peter here, and then I'll have a reference in the Gospels. And that's where we go to that reference in the Gospels and see this actually happening in his life, and then relate that to what he's saying many years later to these listeners that he's writing to. So let's go to the Gospel first, John chapter 20. Let's go to this first one. In John chapter 20, verses 1 through 10. And so, you know, John 20 is where we read about the resurrection of Christ. And just notice in these first 10 verses, Peter's involvement here. Okay, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. Then she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciples whom Jesus loved, that's Peter and John, and said to them, "They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." Peter, therefore, went out, and the other disciple, and were going to the tomb. They both ran together, and the other disciple outran Peter and came to the tomb first. And he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen cloths lying there, yet he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb. And he saw the linen cloths lying there, and the handkerchief that had been around his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded together in a place by itself. Then the other disciple who came to the tomb first went in also, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not know the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. Then the disciples went away again to their own homes. And so if we go over in light of that narrative, that story there from Peter, and read what he says about the resurrection of Christ, the very beginning now, you can imagine the impact that that had on Peter to see that his Lord was gone. And I think, you know, John believed, I think Peter did too, doesn't specifically say he did, that he had risen from the dead, or that, you know, they had this hope that he had. So 1 Peter 3 says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." When he writes this, he no doubt is thinking about when he went into the tomb and saw the tomb was empty. And then he writes again in verse 21 of this same chapter, "Who through him," he's talking about us now, "believe in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God." And then again later in chapter 3 in verse 21, when he says, and this is one we were just talking about, "There is an antitype that also saves you, baptism, not the removal of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience towards God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ." No doubt Peter must have thought about the significance of now of what he witnessed firsthand when he went into the tomb. And so I mean, just the first of many things that Peter was a firsthand witness of. Then look at the next one, the trial of faith. Luke 22. What's he talking about there in Luke 22? Remember what Jesus said to Peter? Luke 22, verse 32. I'm going to back up. He says, the Lord said in verse 31, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. I think about Job when I read this verse. You remember Job coming in the presence of God and talking about Job and the devil and talking about Job, and he lets him sift him as wheat. He says, Satan has asked for you. How would you feel if you found out Satan had asked for you? He wanted to sift you. That would scare me to death. I don't know about y'all, but I'm sure it's probably happened with all of us. But Jesus tells him, Peter, Satan has asked for you. Jesus says, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Is that not what he's doing here in 1 Peter? Strengthening his brethren. Look at 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 7. He says that the genuineness, talking about the trials, that if need be we'll go through these various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Peter writes this and can say, I've gone through it. I've gone through it. I've stumbled. I have failed. I have gotten back up. And he is going, you remember, and we're going to look at this in just a moment. You remember Peter and Jesus' discussion after he rose from the dead. We'll read that in just a moment. But the precious blood of Christ. Now, he later in chapter 1, he wants us to say, okay, he tells us, be holy for I am holy. And he tells us just after that to consider, you know, in light of his, you know, telling us to be holy, consider what you were redeemed with. Think about that. You know, that's pretty serious, that you were redeemed with the pure blood, the precious blood, he calls it in my version, the precious blood of Christ. That's verse 19 there. With the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. Matthew 26. And if somebody's there, feel free to jump in here. I'm probably pretty slow getting over there. Verse 28. So, at the Last Supper with Jesus, Jesus mentions in the presence of Peter, for this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. And we can probably quote any of the Gospels for that. But Peter, no doubt, thinks about that as he talks about here, asking his readers to think about the blood that was shed for you. And in his imperative to tell us to be holy. Anybody have any thoughts? Want to add any thoughts or have any questions? It did. It's obvious in all of his sermons. It's obvious in his writing of 1 Peter that he wants to share that. It's important to him. Christ the living stone. Now think about Matthew 16, verse 18. What's the discussion in Matthew 16? When Jesus is together with the apostles, who do they say that I am? You know, and they went back and forth, and he asked Peter, who do you say that I am? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And he tells him, you know, in the reference about the rock, he says, and upon this rock I shall build my church. Now, in 1 Peter, he says in chapter 2, verse 4 through 6, he goes into a discussion about coming to him, coming to Jesus, that is, as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Therefore, and then he goes on to quote scripture from Isaiah and Psalms, two from Isaiah and one from Psalms, Psalm 18. 118, excuse me. And he uses this metaphor of a rock or a stone, just as Jesus had done with him back in Matthew 16. And then also the sinlessness of Christ. Look at John 8. Please interject. Anybody that has any questions or comments, we'll spend the rest of our time looking at these if we don't. So hopefully I get excited thinking about these things. So just trying to get into the mind of Peter as he writes this book and think about what he's thinking about. John 8 and verse 46, the text says, "Which of you convicts me of sin?" Jesus is speaking here. He says, "Which of you convicts me of sin? And if I tell the truth, why do you not believe me?" What's the rest of the verse? Chapter 14 and verse 30. Jesus also speaking, "I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming, and he has nothing. He has nothing in me." In other words, that last statement, meaning that he is sinless. And then Peter describes him. There's no doubt that he heard Jesus say other things in reference to his sinlessness, but chapter 2, verse 21 through verse 23, we recall this, "To this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example, that you should follow in his steps." Then he quotes from Isaiah again. Chapter 53, "Who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, did not revile in return, when he suffered, did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously." So thinking about the sinlessness of Christ, his example to us in holy living. One of the best sermons I ever heard, I think, it was a good sermon. It's not the best one I've heard, but it was a good sermon on what Jesus didn't say is what it was about. And it was out of 1 Peter 2 here, talking about that he did not revile, he did not threaten, etc. The things he didn't say. Thoughts, questions? Anybody? Is this exciting stuff to y'all? I mean, does this make sense? Trying to get into the mind of Peter as he writes this letter. I think it affects the readers too. They're going to know that. I mean, he's not shy about saying that he was an eyewitness of Christ. Yes. They do, and we'll get into this more when we get into the study of that chapter, but he also, and this is kind of to Stanley's point I think he was making earlier, that he's telling us, you are this people, we are this people to God, so that we can do something. Right, so he goes on to say that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And we do that in a large part by being the people that he's describing in the book throughout these chapters, by being holy to God. Thank you for that comment. The death on the cross, this is a pretty, would have to be one that he thinks about often. Look at Luke 23. I would think that he thinks about it often. Luke 23, verse 26 through 49. We're not going to read that whole thing. But it's describing Jesus on the cross as he begins in verse 26 when Simon begins to carry his cross all the way through the time that he dies verse 49 there where they all, verse 49, but all of his acquaintances and the women who followed him from Galilee stood at a distance watching these things. Peter would have seen the crucifixion of Christ. And no doubt that would have had an impact on him. It is here in a couple of places in 1 Peter 2:24, who himself, just continuing on from what we read a moment ago, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. And then also chapter 3 and verse 18, for Christ also suffered once for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit. And it's from that statement that he goes on and talks about how he saved Noah and the baptism that saves us. And then Christ, the shepherd of our souls. It's significant that he uses the term shepherd. You remember back in John, look at John chapter 10. I'm wanting to find the one. Let's move down to number 10 because that talks about it a little bit too, about shepherding and the flock. Number 10 says John 21, verse 15 through 17. This is the one I was alluding to earlier. Y'all remember here this story, 15 through 17? You remember when they were eating breakfast, Jesus and Peter, and Jesus asked Peter the question, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? He asked him that three times. And, you know, oftentimes we make this significance about the different Greek words that use there with love. But I'm not sure that we may make too much of a deal of that. But he's telling him here what? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said, feed my lambs. And then he said also again, tend my sheep in verse 16. And then he said in verse 17, feed my sheep after the third time. In other words, he's telling him to be a shepherd. Tend the flock of God, he says over in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2. And who's he talking to there? Right? He's talking to the elders of those areas, those elders. The map's not up there anymore. To tend the flock of God. Peter, doesn't Peter say that he is a fellow elder? He does in verse 1. You know, and he has to be thinking about the time when Jesus was himself telling him to do this. I don't know. There's a connection there for me when I think about that to Jesus. Peter telling me to tend the flock, Jesus personally told Peter to. But Stanley, do you have a point? Mm-hmm. So in you're talking about in the sense of reaching out to the lost and bringing them in. And you know, maybe you're right there, and thinking about the parables that Jesus told and the lost sheep, I think the application there really is directed towards the Christian who's left the fold, and you go back and get him and bring him back. But, I mean, it's the same, I don't know if it's the same exact work, but it's that same care and love for the souls of people, right, that we're talking about that motivates that. Any other thoughts? Well, we're really out of time. I'm going to stop there. So if you have any last comments, we have about 1 minute left. If you have another comment or question, please feel free to speak up. It is. To think that he asked for Peter. Has he ever asked for me? You know, it's certainly not beyond our comprehension that he could have asked for any or all of us in this room at some point to sift us. It's a scary thought. Yeah. Stanley? He does. You're right. I think you're right about that. I mean, it's just it's just scary to think about, and that he may still do it again. You know? Yeah. What if we live in such a way that, you know, and you think about Job too, though. Job's the one that brought it up to Satan. But here it seems as though Satan asked the Lord. So, yeah, good point. All right, we'll pick up here next time. And I have, in the beginning is a syllabus. I had us getting into chapter 1 today. I intentionally didn't do that. So we will, we'll just kind of feel it out. We'll go as far as we can next time. So be sure and look at the next two lessons for next week. So we won't finish both of those probably in one day, one study. But we might get into the Holy People of God lesson next week too. So appreciate everyone's participation this morning and kind attention. We'll pick up there next week.